Okay, everybody. Let's give our featured speaker a round of applause. Ray.
I'm only nervous for a minute. Hi, everybody. My name is Reyes. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date is the 5th of February, 1983. And my home group is the Saturday Night Rainbow Group in Visalia. Everyone's welcome. My sponsor is Doug B. with 34 years of sobriety. And if we're not for Alcoholics Anonymous, who would be able to do this? This is not normal for me to stand and talk like this. I get a little nervous, I do, but I'll get there. I spoke with my sponsor. I always talk to my sponsor to get reminded about, you know, spreading the message and not the mess. And he says, if I get you nervous, I can lie. So. Yeah, my sponsor probably. I love humor in Alcoholics Anonymous. I truly do. And he said, you know, like I've always heard, you know, share about my experience and what happened, and most importantly, what's going on today, you know, because people know how to get drunk, and alcoholics need to know how to stay sober. And with my 29 years of sobriety, one day at a time, it is all because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the amazing examples of the men and women in these rooms. So with that, you know, just and I always feel like I should say a disclaimer or something about my life, and I tend to edit some of it because I don't like to make people uncomfortable with where my alcoholism took me and the type of, like, when Joe, thank you for your share. I relate to people when they talk about issues as young people and so forth. And I come from an area where it was okay for the men, the boys, I should say, okay for us to drink. And I'm Mescalero Apache, so I res near southeastern New Mexico. And I remember when we were growing up, they used to have these little half beers. I always mention this, and I don't know if they even make them anymore, but these little cans, and they would give them to us. And I was probably 5 years old, so like that. And that wasn't my drinking. I mean, if I drank them, but that wasn't when I was, I did not consider that drinking alcoholically. And it was okay for the boys to drink, not the girls. And our home life, I just figured everybody was like that. Abusive, scary, it was hard. It was a hard life, and I didn't know it. Growing up, I didn't know we were money poor, but not poor in other ways. We raised a lot of our own food. We hunted, hand-me-down clothes. My mom made a lot of our clothes and stuff like that. And we were relative, you know, had fun, you know, whatever fun you could have. But what happened was, for me, was in the area, like I said, it was a hard life, and not knowing that. And alcohol was always present, and for Native people, alcohol really was always present. My generation was the one that started with the outside issues of drugs and so forth. But up until that time, it was alcohol, and it was okay to drink, and it was okay to see the kids fall down, and they would laugh at him and so forth like that, and it was accepted. So I was starting, and I always like to mention, you know, all these mixed messages that I was getting when I was growing up. I got a lot of mixed messages, a lot of them. It was okay to drink. It was okay to, I didn't know what getting drunk was. It was something that happened when we drank that stuff, you know. And I remember I was about 8 years old. This is about the hard life I talked about. I thought it was just fun picking cotton. You know, we picked cotton. I was 8 years old, picking cotton, started driving a Chevy pickup, you know, and when I was about nine, you know, because my dad showed us how to drive, you know, out in the fields and so forth. So there, you know, stuff like that. I just figured it was normal. I was probably 8 or 9 years old when they gave us a rifle to go shoot with, you know. I look at kids nowadays, and I'm like, a kid at 8 years old, a rifle, you know, I'm like, what the hell is these people thinking, you know? But, I mean, it was normal. It was all these mixed messages and stuff. And when they really got it, the encouraging thing for me was the abuse at an early age. They used to beat us so that we wouldn't cry. But the boys don't cry. The men don't cry. That was another mixed message I had. I got beat. Yeah, I really did. When I was in around 10 years of age, I am a survivor of sexual abuse, and that was a really horrendous time for me for those couple of years. And this is one of those mixed messages I got early on, because they would, I just figured how I tied in with, we would hear about God in these rooms and spirituality in this program and so forth like that, and I just had given up, you know, I just thought, God, you know, I'm a bad kid, I'm going to hell anyway, because they used to make us go to church, this First Southern Baptist Church, and we sat in the back of the church, and the white people sat in the front, and I remember, I didn't understand what the word heathen was, but the preacher would yell at it, to yell it out, and look at us, you know, directly at me, you know, like, heathens are going to hell, so I figured I was going to hell anyway, so, another mixed message I got in my early life, so when this stuff started happening to me about the sexual abuse and so forth, I was around 19 years of age, I can't remember, I'd just given up on God, and I just give it up on the church and thinking that anyone's going to help me, you know. And that's when I started, and I know this, that's when I started to drink. And I look back at this point in my life, because it's really when I look at it, when I was starting to drink alcoholically at that time, and I somehow got a hold of an 80-proof Bacardi rum bottle. And the reason I talk about drinking alcoholically is I didn't drink the whole bottle. I left about maybe an inch because I didn't want to get in trouble for drinking the whole bottle, you know. So I left a little bit and I got violently ill. So what it did, it started this amazing medicine for me to numb what was going on in my life, to make sense of the nonsense, to make sense of the abuse. And I didn't know that. I just thought that was normal that went on. So my drinking, I talked about alcoholically drinking about the age of 11, and my progression was pretty quick. I couldn't get enough because I needed to numb myself emotionally. I'd already died spiritually, and then the physical stuff, you know, even when I broke a bone or something like that, or had a broken bone, you know, I would numb it with the alcohol, and I couldn't get enough alcohol. I just, you know, stealing it or doing what I had to do with it. And then with that progression, of course, I started to go to bars when I was 16 years old. And doing things that I needed to do when I didn't have, because I didn't have the money to drink the way I needed to drink. And as I say, you know, the people talk about their stories, a lot of fun, and this is some fun for me too, but I get pretty tragic too. And then I became a little, first of all, I hate to say it, but it's just a male prostitute. I also noticed that people in the bars were watching people around pool tables, and I needed the attention. I sought out the attention. And so what I did, I started to learn to play pool. And I became quite good at it. I was a little pool shark. And to get that, to pay for drinks and for money. And again, my drinking had played more from that 80 proof. I was now drinking 151. And I drank 151. That was my drug of choice, 151. And I got to mention that one time at a bar, this man saw me ordering a drink, and he lit my drink on fire. And I almost beat him up, and made him buy me a couple of drinks, because I didn't know he lit on fire. I did not know that. And he lit my drink on fire. But that's how I drank. I drank like that. I drank a lot. My blackouts, I didn't know what blackouts were. That was the other part I want to bring up, is the fact that I didn't know what blackouts were. I learned a lot of stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. Found out how sick I really was. And I just thought I was crazy. You know, God had given up on me. I'm going to hell anyway. And when I drank, I would end up in places. And I always had good intentions. I always like to mention, I always had good intentions to go out and have fun, you know, and have a good time. And I never thought about trouble, you know. And I was a little hell raiser, too, and I was a good street fighter. I did a little problem. I had anger issues. And I did not know at that time in my early years, you know, that what had happened to me had really twisted me up so much that I had a very short fuse, especially toward tall white men. Going out to the bars where I was and the places I hung out, if you were a tall white man, there was some reason, like, you know, I would go after him just to, with a pool stick, with a bar chair, I was just not a nice guy to be around. And that wasn't my intention. It really wasn't. It was just, again, all those mixed messages I could get. But my drinking, because the way I had to drink, I went to places where I wasn't welcomed. And after I drank a little while, they really didn't welcome me, you know. The cops would be called, and the times I got locked up were fighting, and I only had, and I've got to mention this, in my drinking time, I only got 3 DUIs, but I'm a blackout drunk driver, and for a lot of years, I drank and drove drunk. And I want to talk myself about being a menace to society. I truly was. When I was 18, I met my first partner, and I didn't know anything about gay bars. You know, I was going to redneck bars and honky tonks, and I could, you know, two-step and Cotton Eye Joe and Dokey Go and Blue Little Waltz with the best of them. I just loved to be on the dance floor, and not that I was interested in the women. I was just wanted to be, you know, in the, you know, to be noticed, you know. And gosh, those were some fun times. They really were. But they always ended up pretty bad and dark. They really did. But when I was 18, my partner took me to my first gay bar, and I thought I died and went to heaven, because I didn't know there were other people like me. I didn't. And again, that was the progression more of my disease. And I was able to use my little talent to get more drinks, and also got into more of the drugs, which added to my twisted behavior. And there was always more. I became addicted to more. More of anything. And anything would just change the way I felt or what I thought. And there were some men that called me a chameleon, because I never was comfortable with who I was. And they never knew that it was just a game for them, how I was going to come out that night, you know, in a military outfit or grudge or what. I was a chameleon. I just fit in to get what I needed, and like a little thief in the night, and just get what I wanted and get away and drink. And I drank a lot. I didn't realize how much damage I was doing to my body. Spiritually, like I said, I was already dead. And when I got to be out, I was in my early 20s, I guess it was, when I found out about freebasing cocaine. And that in itself, I go, how do people get addicted to coke? I said, I was always looking at the differences, you know. But cocaine helped me drink more. It really did. I remember getting really sore jaws from that stuff. But man, I could just drink and drink and not, and for days, you know, days. That was a little twisted part of my late 70s, early 80s time. My drinking also ended up, helped me, but also, you know, I don't like talking about some of the stuff that I talk about, but this is about a program of honesty and how bad it got for me. And because I didn't have the money to drink the way I drank, and early on when I got sick, you know, all I could think of when I was vomiting was them wasting this booze. So I ended up with an eating disorder, because I figured if I don't eat, I won't throw up. So I would not eat for long periods of time. So when I was brought in, when I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, that was another issue I had to deal with. I had a lot of issues I had to deal with. But so I would binge eat, drink constantly, but it was really a sick thing for me to, and it was hard for me to admit that to another human being, you know, because it was another sign of weakness. And where I grew up, and that's one thing I wanted to bring up, is that we were told and taught not to ask white people for anything. I didn't know what a black person looked like until I came to California. And we knew our place. There were signs in stores that said dogs and Mexicans out back. I mean, you couldn't even go into the, my dad couldn't go into the front of the store. He had to go around the back. He was going to get groceries for us and so forth. These are a lot of mixed messages I used to see growing up. And so it's easier for, I feel it's easier now for people to come into Alcoholics Anonymous and stay here instead of like broken and all these mixed messages that I had at the age of 25 when I was brought in here. I'm 55 today and I've not had it necessary to drink, but before I got to 55, I was so messed up. And I thought I was doing okay. You know, doing life. I really was. I was having fun, you know. I didn't realize how sick I was. I had tried to commit suicide a couple of times in my teenage years. I actually overdosed a couple of times, and I remember one of the times I remember coming out of it and cussing at a God I didn't believe in because I came out of it. You know, I didn't intend to overdose. It was just stuff that happened. You know, I forget. Well, you know, I was like a pharmacist. You know, I had all these pills and all these powders, and of course I had my booze, and then I had my company booze. You know, and man, don't ever look above the refrigerator and try to touch my stuff. And, man, I would just go off. You know, I did not like people touching my stuff. But I would just want to get to that point, and it was like go over. Well, there's one time that I got to share with you about overdosing was I was in. Wow. I still can't tell if I was 2 or 3 days in the bed before this lady that I worked at a Valley Medical Center in Fresno, actually. I worked there, and one of the nurses there was a friend of mine, and they were concerned about me. And she got the manager to open the apartment door, and they found me, she found me, in my bed. And I had been passed out on a vomit. You imagine what other bodily fluids there were after a couple of days in that bed, and cigarette burn marks on my chest because I passed out with a cigarette on me. And so it's a miracle I didn't burn the place down, you know, the way I was. Because I used to reach over in the mornings, and I was one of those people who spit the cigarette butt out of the drink to get to the liquor. I did that, you know. It was not pretty toward the last years of my drinking. Anyway, my friend Patricia found me, picked me up, and I had withered. I was so thin by then. I'll keep pretty healthy now. But I had withered so much, and I didn't realize, and I didn't know what the bleeding was about. I bled out of my mouth and other orifices, and I didn't know where that blood was coming from, but I would drink more to get that blood taste out of my mouth. And she picked me up, and I still remember wanting to look good, you know. Said, "Come take me to the hospital where we work," you know, because I didn't want them to know how bad, you know. They already knew about some other lies I'd tell them in the emergency room. But so she took me to a private doctor of hers, and I said, "This is sick alcoholic that I am, or I was at that time." They gave me a quick little history, and they asked me how much I was drinking, and I told them, "Oh, good 10 or 12, you know, drinks." And they were like, surprise, you know. Oh, ooh, that was before I left my apartment. You know, those are my drinks. You know, I didn't tell about my drinking. You know, and I still remember to this day that doctor telling me, "Well, you know, cut down on that and get some rest." And all I heard was "get some rest." So I went out that night, because I went out every night. Went out, and I remember telling the bartender, "My doctor says I have to get some rest. You know." I got to get out of here by 12 o'clock. And I lasted maybe 2 nights. Maybe 3, but I remember it was no more than that. But I drank twice or 3 times as much before midnight so that I can, you know, find somebody and take them home and drink more at home. But in my mind, I was getting rest because I was leaving the bar at 12 o'clock. That didn't last long, like I said. Sick stuff that I did, really sick stuff. Anyway, that's like a little tip of the iceberg on my drinking and my behavior. So like that, I like to talk about, you know, now what had happened. In September 1980, my partner died of drinking and driving, and I didn't make the connection even at that time. 23rd of September, 1980, he went through a four-week, he thought it was a four-week stop, but it wasn't, it was a two-week stop, and he got killed, and that, to me, was even more of a downfall for me, because I ended up with this hole in me that I didn't know how to fill it, you know, and all I could do was, like, again, one of those automatic things as an alcoholic, drink more, and this was in 1980, of course, I had a few more years in my drinking, and I didn't even talk about the time I got locked up in New Mexico before I almost killed a man, I got hit. I was going to break up a fight, because I just, my intentions were to go out and have a good time with my brothers and stuff, and my younger brother started to fight, and I went to break it up, because I just wanted to drink. And the guy that I was breaking up the fight, I didn't know who he was, and he hit me. I don't like, again, remember, I was physically abused as a child, so I don't like to get hit in the face. I didn't even play slap. I'm a lot better now. And this guy hit me, and not knowing who I was, and not bragging or anything like that, but I was pretty busted back then. I really was. I was all that. And I hit that man so hard. I still remember, like, flying up to see his boots or his feet coming up off the ground when I hit him. And he flew back and hit a phone booth because it was in the bar. And I split his head open and almost killed him. Ended up from that, I didn't know half that bar with his friends of his, and ended up fighting all these guys in the street with there was a sawed-off shotgun, brass knuckles, it was just knives. I'd been shot at, and I was having a good time, you know? Leave me alone. These guys, at least, you know, it was just and that was not, you know, once in a while. It happened more than not. I just don't like to talk about that stuff. But I just could feel it in a brand of not. It was really sad and sick. Because I hurt a lot of people. I really did. What ended up happening was, for myself, after my partner died, I drank more and more. My blackouts were more severe. People were concerned about me because I would show up at work at the emergency room when I was on one of the shifts that I wasn't supposed to be on, and I would lie to them, like, oh, I forgot something in my locker or whatever, reeking of booze, and I used to, at one of the desks, I'd get the alcohol swab. I had the cleanest desk in the whole office. I cleaned my desk with those alcohol, because I was reeking of booze, just pouring out, coming out of my pores. It's just, but I had a clean desk, and I really did. Like nobody knew. God, it was awful. I was just lying to myself. What ended up happening was I lost a lot of friends from my partner dying to other friends of mine dying. And I never connected the dots, you know, of the overdoses, the suicide. I could think of some amazing good friends of mine that hung themselves. Even this past year, a little earlier I talked about it, when it means one of my cousins, at 9 o'clock in the morning, put a gun to his head. He was 50 years old and killed himself. And a few months after that, another cousin of mine overdosed. He was about 46. And as a recovering alcoholic, I can have that empathy for them. That was their best thinking at that time, my cousins. You know, the disease is lies or not in my family. And I have other family members that go, how could they do that? All heartbroken. I said, well, that's the best they could do at that time. You know, I was just too chicken shit to put the gun to my head. But I was killing myself in other ways. I truly was. And the main thing that I killed was the spirit within me. And what ended up happening was, and I want to talk about the recovery part of my life and how grateful I am for Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm here today and I had the opportunity to share, you know, that this program does work, you know, for someone like me, where I came from, where I was so different than, and anyway. The last day when I was the month before the last drink I had, I was sentenced, I had to go in front of a judge in January. I couldn't be quitting drinking in the holidays. That was another difference that I had. Why would someone quit drinking in November? It's the best time to drink, you know? I used to tell people, it's my birthday, 3 months before July, you know? I get drinks, you know? Just lies. Anyway, after that, I was like, why would people, if you're a real alcoholic, you wouldn't stop drinking in November or December. Those are party times, you know? And the thing about college, I want to mention this one last thing about before I quit drinking, before I actually quit drinking. I went away to college because the Vietnam War had ended, even though I didn't list it. I needed to do something. I wanted to do something different. My brother was over in Vietnam, and I wanted to go. And the war ended, and I go, you know, God hates me. You know, I think that. So I said, I'll go to school because I want to try something different. So I went to college, registered for business administration, and I remember being told by a white professor, Mr. Dr. Sanders, you know, if you want to be in making business, you got to cut your hair, wear blue slacks, black shoes, a white shirt. And so I did that, and I started, you know, I cut my hair, and also, you know, I took those directions. That just felt awful for a long time. It just felt terrible cutting my hair because of my people, that's a traditional thing. And anyway, I did that, but I only lasted about until my third, maybe even my third semester. And I thought, God, this drinking is just in the way. You know, I got to stop. And then I'll quit for a semester, and then I'll get this out of my system, and I'll finish school. Well, 12 years later, I was able to go back to school. It just, you know, I didn't get it. I didn't understand how alcohol had its claws in me, and I didn't have the tools. I didn't know how not to drink. When I got to the point where I was sentenced in January, the beginning of January of 1983, I still didn't get it. You know, I was looking at prison time after these other offenses I'd had, and they were fine. I didn't even know some of the stuff that they were saying I had done. I go, well, all right, I guess so. You know, I don't remember doing that stuff. And they were going to send me to prison. And I didn't like getting locked up. And I've been locked up 6 or 7 times, and I didn't like it. I don't recommend that for anybody, but take what it takes. And I drank for another month. And for me, when I started trudging this road to happy destiny, what ended up happening on the 5th of February, 1983, I was in my two bedroom filthy apartment, all by myself. I didn't have any. I had one friend, Richard, who was in this program because he needed it. And I remember drinking that, and I tell people I was reduced to a tall Budweiser. That's what I was reduced to drinking, you know, on the floor in my living room. And I remember it was the longest drink that I can remember drinking. It took me 30 minutes to drink that tall Bud. And when it was done, it was literally was like drinking air. Alcohol, for me, stopped working that morning. And when I finished sipping the can, I looked at the clock, and it was 10 o'clock in the morning. That was my last drink. I thought, okay, now what? Well, God told me what. I'd never gone through withdrawal. You know what that was. I didn't know what to expect. And the next day, I wasn't feeling well. And I called my friend Richard, and I said, I don't feel good. He goes, oh, that's okay. You're just having DTs. You know, they'll pass in a couple of days. Well, this alcohol, the way I pickled myself, I had about 6 days of extreme serious withdrawals. And my friend Richard was coming to pick me up and taking me to meetings. And back then, we didn't have styrofoam cups. We had mugs and tin ashtrays, you know, stuff. And this is something that I vaguely remember, and I still do remember. I actually withdrew in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. Sweating, diarrhea. It was not pretty. And I couldn't drink. One of the times I was at a meeting, I couldn't hold my cup. I was shaking so badly. And all I could do was hang on to the metal chair. And somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous stood behind me. I don't know who this person was, man or woman. I don't know. It was just a member of this program, stood behind me and helped me drink my coffee. That is unconditional love. To this day, I still gravitated toward an alcoholic in the room of Alcoholics Anonymous who's sweating and stinky. And I gravitate toward that person because they remind me of how bad it was for me. And I thought I was doing okay. You know, you look around the room right now, we don't see people like that. But I don't very often. But that was me. Anyway, I had about 6 days of serious withdrawals. And then I had about maybe 5 days of okay, just feeling kind of okay. And I remember waking up on the fifth day or whatever after that, and for some reason I looked down and my hands were shaking, and I don't know why, but I knew, oh no, they're back. And I had another series of withdrawals just as severe as the first one for about another 4 or 5 days. And I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous for a while, and I've heard of 2 other men and a woman share their story with me that they've had like 3 sets like that. So it takes what it takes for it to get. So I did not know I was detoxing like that. I didn't know it was that bad. But my friend Richard, during all this time, was picking me up and taking me to meetings. I couldn't hear anything. You know, I couldn't hear anything. And I felt so uncomfortable in these rooms because they were all, and I talk about this, all older white people, and they're probably like 30, you know. I was 25 years of age, and I mentioned this because I was looking at all the differences. And I thought, geez, what are these people? How are they going to help me? How can they possibly understand what I have been through? Well, all these little things that I talked about, and I don't want to minimize it because that's serious stuff. About the sexual abuse, about the overdoses, about the attempted suicides, about trying to, you know, kill somebody or even wanting to kill myself, and these crazy thoughts, and that I was insane, you know. I really had accepted the fact that I was insane. That made sense to me, you know. It's a big pop out, you know. Anyway, these people kept telling me, keep coming back, they ended up telling me that, you know, not to talk because I was a newcomer, and that was a real big one for me because they would tell me, take the cotton out of your ears and stick it in your mouth. You can't tell us a different way of getting drunk. You need to listen to us, so how to stay sober. And they were mean to me, you know, and I thought, geez, don't they know I wanted them to help, you know, I really wanted to help. And I had stuff to say, you know, at that time. And they wouldn't let me. And I needed that. And back then, it was all about alcohol. It truly was. People could even talk about Prozac. They would just shut you up. You couldn't talk about any outside issues. Like I didn't understand traditions yet or any of that. I didn't understand that. I just felt uncomfortable about women's boobs and the God word on the wall. Uncomfortable. I didn't want to be there. And what was happening was I detoxed enough where I started to hear messages that made sense. I go, oh, not only for the men, but the women in the room, because I never had anything in common with women other than attraction for men. And I started hearing true messages about my disease. And I go, what disease? I have disease. You know, what the hell? I'm okay. You know, because again, I thought I was doing okay. And I kept hearing about this being a disease. And so then when I started getting the opportunity to talk, I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was like a group therapy, you know. I didn't realize how far down my existence had gone. So when I started sharing stuff at that time, it was made a lot of people uncomfortable in the rooms. My home group was the Fresno Fellowship. And that's when I started first hearing, you know, people nudging me, oh, you don't need to share that. You need to get a sponsor and work on those issues, you know, debt. And I go, and again, it was about that thing about white people. I go, how am I going to ask a white man to help me? You know, how's a white man going to feel? Because again, that mixed message I had growing up, you don't ask white people for anything. You know, I didn't understand how this program worked. I just didn't want to hurt anymore. And I didn't want to go to prison. So I'd already been sentenced to a program in Fresno and so forth like that. So anyway, what ended up happening was, I looked around the room and I kept hearing about sponsorship. I'll share this because this is not the way you pick a sponsor. And there was this guy, Bill Moore. Yeah, big, tall, white guy, leather jacket, tough, you know. And, you know, that's the one for me. So I go, he's the one who probably can handle me. So, and he was at a lot of the meetings I went to. And at that time I was going to 2, 3, sometimes 4 meetings a day. And I did that for over a year and a half. Because I heard, you know, if you drank every day, you go to a meeting every day. Well, I drank a hell of a lot, so I figured I'd go to a lot of meetings. You know, and I did. And in Fresno, we had them early in the morning, before work, noontime, right after work. We had candlelight meetings at 11 o'clock. I couldn't sleep anyway, you know, so I was always in meetings. The other thing was I want to mention was I was also financially bankrupt. And I was literally starving in my early recovery. And I loved the donuts, and when someone had birthdays, they had cakes, I was able to really gorge on that stuff, and then I would go home and get violently ill because of my eating disorder, but I was starving in Alcoholics Anonymous. and not knowing again, I didn't know how to ask for help. And the thing about my sponsor was, after the meeting, I would go up, and because I see a lot of people talk, gravitated toward Bill, and they'd be a tall guy, and they'd always be talking to him, and stuff. So I would go, and I'd stand by him, behind him, you know, and I kept waiting. It took almost 3 weeks before I said, I had an anger issue already. I kept waiting. It was almost 3 weeks. I kept doing this behavior, going after the meeting, standing behind him, waiting for him to ask me if he could sponsor me. You know? And finally one day, I was so mad at this man. He looked down at me and goes, what? He goes, well, I'm waiting for you to ask me to sponsor me. He goes, no, you have to ask me. So he was teaching about being humble, that humility. And he taught me a whole bunch of stuff. And that word, I thought meant weak. I didn't like that word, and he taught me about being ignorant, which I didn't like that either, you know, and I didn't understand what that was. He taught me, he was very patient, my friend, but Bill ended up taking me under his wing, sharing with me about the big book, and then he shared with me how to work the steps, which he explained to me about spiritual principles tied to every step. He had me work a step, read a tradition, and do a step, do a tradition, and so forth, ask questions, go to meetings, go to writing meetings, do write, praying, and I said, what? And again, there's that whole mixed message about God. I don't think I pray. What do you mean? I don't know how to pray. He says to me, get the big book, and you go to page 63, and you read this, the third step prayer, you know. And then you just get that down pat, you read this, page 76, you know, 7th step prayer. He showed me the other prayers, 11th step prayer, you know, on page 87 or 80, whatever. You know, and that big book number says, oh, but when God is present in my life, when I work with another individual, I remember stuff, you know. I like to keep stuff light when I'm sharing because, like I said, my life and with my drinking and drugs and my behavior got really, really sick and really uncomfortable. And I don't like people make people uncomfortable. But I can give an example, good or bad, that this program does work. And I know today God doesn't make junk. You know, there's just some bad stuff happened to good people. And I'm just a sick person trying to stay well. And my sponsor, Bill Moore, when he sat with me and helped me write out inventories, and that was scary, putting stuff on paper. You know, the sexual inventory, I said, really, that was like bragging at first, you know, and then it got real, you know, and I would hide that, and I was afraid someone was going to break in my filthy two-bedroom apartment and find my stuff, like, they're going to read my stuff, you know, and I would carry with me to work and hide it in my desk. Anyway, it's just a lot of uncomfortable stuff, but anyway, my sponsor, when I share with him my, where I was able to do my thing. Because I thought, truly, I only had one shot at sobriety. I didn't know about the 10th step yet. So I was very thorough in my 4th step. Very thorough. It took me several months to do a lot. I had a lot of writing. And when I finally was able to sit with my sponsor on all these papers, and I still remember him ripping them out of my hand, just come through and said, can you read it to me? And I still remember to this day when I was reading my 5th step, with my sponsor, he cringed a few times, and I just felt bad that I was making this wonderful man feel bad about the stuff that I had done to others, to myself. You know, it was just, it was a lot of sick stuff in my existence. But you know what? That man sat with me and went through that 4th column about my part. And again, here I am thinking I knew it all. And I didn't. I said, what part? I don't have part in this. You bastards, you know, screwed me up and blah, blah, blah. And I got, you know, I'm not even getting details of what happened as a kid, but it was really awful. I said, this is terrible stuff. You know, little kids aren't supposed to bleed like that, you know. And, you know, they're supposed to have broken bones like that, you know. That wasn't my fault. And he tells me that was the first time in my life that someone told me that I was a victim. That was relief. That was a big relief when he explained that to me. You know, I just thought I was a bad kid, that I deserved all that stuff. And that's why I drank. I wanted to numb that. He didn't stop. But we trudged on, and he told me on that column where I was affecting my, you know, I was pissed off, angry. He goes, you know what, my sponsor pissed me off a lot. And he says, you know, Rick, was when you could go back, that was great. Because the, you know, that's the government name. The government changed all our names to English, and I keep a tribal name as well, and so forth. But he says, Ray, everywhere you put, you're upset, mad, you know, angry. He goes, we're going to find out what you're afraid of. And that pissed me off when my sponsor told me. Really, I was angry at my sponsor because I said, no, I'm not afraid. You know, you don't understand. I've been shot at. I've been fighting. You know, you don't understand. He goes, and so on my part, he helped me. Because that fear that I had on my life, all those years, and why I drank to numb that, it was really awful. But he was very patient with me and helped me look at where I was afraid and why I did my behavior and why I acted the way I did and why I reacted to situations in life the way I did. And it wasn't a quick thing for me. You know, it's talked about in the big book, you know, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. And my current sponsor says I'm a quick learner, but I'm a slow applier, you know, and that's true for me today. So I'm better at that today. But my sponsor got me involved not only with the steps, but understanding how to work them, how to apply the spiritual principles to my life, how to make a commitment to the meeting. My first commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous was a greeter, because he knew I didn't like to be touched. And there were those women boobs again, you know, being hugged, and I didn't like that. So he made me commit, and he says, remember you said you commit to going any lengths to your sobriety, you know, yeah, yeah, yeah. So he had to show up early for the meeting, my home group, and it was weeks, probably a month or so later until he finally told me. He was getting there earlier, sitting in the car somewhere, to see if I got there. He wanted to know if I was serious about it. Sure enough, I'd be there. Shake people's hands and give those uncomfortable hugs and help clean up and be a part of this fellowship. You know, those are my baby steps. My sponsor's real big on about baby steps. Huge for me on baby steps. But he also talked to me about and showed me how to do 12-step calls. And back then we did a lot of 12-step calls in the middle of the night, outside of a bar, people's apartments, the park, at the zoo. You know, in the middle of the night. So he got me involved in 12-step calls, and I can honestly say, and I like to say this too, because it's true for me, that all my 12-step calls have been a success, because I'm still sober. You know, I'm still sober because I put myself out there with my sponsor, with other members of this program, to be there to help a suffering alcoholic, get them some help, clean them up, take them to now to these rehab places, the detox places. You know, I've done that. My sponsor also got me involved in hospital institution work. And for 6.5 years in Fresno County, for the first 4 years of that, I carried the message to the Carruthers Institution where I did some time. It's closed now. And they even segregated us there, too. They put me with the brown people, and they had white guys, and then they had, you know, they segregated us there. I didn't know. But I carried the message there with these two other men, and then when that closed down, we were carrying the message to a fire camp for 2.5 years, and that was really amazing work for me, and commitment, and it taught me to be unconditional. Because I was carrying the message to mostly white people at that time. And here I was still not, even though I was sober, I wasn't well. Just because I got sober doesn't mean everything was wonderful and well. It just wasn't. You know, I was still very, you know, fearful and hateful and stuff like that, and didn't believe in the God thing. I kind of did, but things started happening. Wonderful things. Truly wonderful things, you know. I would see, and I mentioned this about the white people then at that time, I would see you getting healthier first before I could see myself. Because white people back then had a lot of red spots on their faces when they came in. And I could see those red spots going away, you know. And they go, why come they looking better? And I'm still messed up. I'm all jacked up, you know. I couldn't see. I didn't understand they did. Because I would never look at myself in the mirror. I had such low self-esteem and so I couldn't look in the mirror. For the longest time, I couldn't look in the mirror. And that was one of those baby steps my sponsor had me do. Because he looked in the mirror and said, Ray, I love you and I forgive you. And I could, for the longest time, I couldn't do that. But I didn't give up. I didn't give up. I kept suiting up and showing up. I kept praying those little prayers in the big book until they started making sense to me. because I would talk to my sponsor about stuff, and he would always piss me off, you know. And at one time, you know, I remember because I was trying to figure stuff out, you know, an easier, softer way. And he says, you know, Reyes, he goes, your analysis causes paralysis. And then that, you know, that didn't make sense to me when he said that, but it pissed me off because he came from him, you know. And I was like, oh, what do you mean? He goes, you just have faith. You know, and he talked to me about that spiritual principle of step two about faith and that surrender and trust, and I got it. You know, today I truly believe in my Creator. Today I believe, you know, again, like I said, God doesn't make junk. You know, and it's only because of Alcoholics Anonymous and what I've learned to live my life, when you have all these silly little things and all these acronyms about hall, hungry, and lonely, tired, or ego edging God out, and the God thing that early on for me, they were talking about a group of drunks or good orderly direction. Those things made sense to me. But now it's God of the Spirit within me, because I no longer kill that spirit. Because of that, I no longer drink, and I do things unconditionally, without any, you know, getting something back from you. I can live a comfortable life. That means it's wonderful. I have problems, you know, and that's what the 10th step is for. You know, and my sponsors that I've had over the years, because Bill moved away. Bill's been my sponsor. I mean, Doug's been my sponsor about 20 years. I love Doug B. He has, like I said, 34 years. And these men and women who are have been here before me show me by their example, you know, where are we? We're in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is how I stay sober. You know, by not saying no to sharing that little tip of the iceberg of my insane drinking life and drug life and sex and all that other stuff, because there's a whole bunch more. And there's nothing that I would not share my own personal life with a sponsor and other suffering alcoholics on a one-on-one basis, because I've learned healthy boundaries in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you all don't need to know all my stuff. You don't, you know. But if there's something that someone comes to me and we pray together, like my sponsor has asked me to do, and showed me how to do that together, holding hands and praying, because we're two or more gathered, you know, God's there. And God has been there a lot for me. I have to share one thing about, you know, why the traditions are so important, and then I'm going to wrap this up. It's almost 25 after. But, I was traveling in Georgia, and I went to Rome, Georgia. When I travel now, I seek out Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to a meeting. I had my friend to take me to a meeting, and he dropped me off at the City Hall meeting place, something like that. And I went in, and I did not know it was for whites only. This was in 1984, 85. And I went in the meeting, and it was for whites only. I did not know that. I didn't know that. And this woman that when I walked in, I mean, it's just like, but this woman pulled her son over and made him shake my hand. And I was pissed. I was so, I mean, getting angry, you know. And I sat down, and I can't remember what went on in that meeting. I was just so angry because I was thinking, these white people can't make me leave, you know. Because I remember the tradition, some of that, the tradition about the third tradition, about the only requirement for AA membership is an honest desire not to drink, and I didn't want to drink. And I didn't understand the other people. So when I came back, I talked to my sponsor, I was so angry. So what it did, it motivated me to learn more about the traditions and how to express them and be a part of the fellowship in a healthy way. And so I went back the following year to look for those bastards, you know, and they've moved, you know. But I had, but what it did, it put the fire under me to learn about, more about how this program works and how to apply those traditions to my life in a good way, you know, and how, because the steps are there to protect me from myself and the traditions are there to protect AA from me. I have no opinion on outside issues, you know, and because of that, I have been able to then sponsor and friends, members of the Clovis KKK, I have a really good friend of mine who's in the White family. I have another friend of mine, kind of dating him, but he was with the Woodpeckers. You know, normally these people would have killed him. We'd have, you know, gotten in horrible fights, you know. But, you know, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, the common denominator in here is about recovery, you know. And not because of their beliefs or how they were raised or whatever like that. I'd rather them be sober. They're less likely to shoot me, you know, if they're in these meetings here. So that makes sense to me today. You know, I don't look at people that color or how they look. So I've had the most amazing men step up to me and ask me to do their sponsor. And this is one of the blessings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I'll be looking and, yo, we laugh. You're a, look. You know? We judge. They say we don't judge. We judge immediately. I sure the hell have. And, this is one of the many, many blessings of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, these men will come to me and ask me if I was, you know, they don't have a lot of cake, you know? And they ask me if I would be their sponsor. As soon as those words come out, lust and all that other stuff goes away. Because then I am there with that individual for the purpose of this program, to help another suffering alcoholic. When people were taking care of me when I couldn't drink my cup of coffee, you know, when I didn't have food to eat, they took me to the Red Robin, and that's one thing I'll share with you, you know, that when the people found out that I was starving coming to these rooms, and I would make excuses when everyone would go out to eat afterwards, and thank you for eating for a meal tonight. That's why I had difficulty accepting those humble things and those wonderful blessings of this program. People started taking me and saying, you know what, we're going to take you, we're going to buy you those Mile High. But they would go out for these Mile High mud pies at Red Robin, and I couldn't afford it. And they said, we're going to buy this for you, and then, you know, later on in your life, you're going to be able to pay back. And I'm so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous that I'm able to pay back, not only by food, but with my time, giving people rides, being present. And the best raise I can be because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's so much more that I could share with you, but it's not about making somebody uncomfortable about where alcohol and drugs took me and my behavior. It's about the gift that I have because I can be here and be present and stand in front of you as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous with all my flaws and say, you know what, it does get better. You know, they didn't promise me better roses, a lot of money and stuff like that, but I'm not a blackout drunk driver. I'm not a menace to society. I care about people. I have the probably 60 men that I used to run with. Back then, I think there's only 3 or 4 of us left. All the other ones are dead. And I'm not making that up. Overdoses, diseases, horrible deaths. And today I get to live. And that's why I am so grateful that I get an opportunity to share a little bit about my twisted life and also the laughter and the amazing friendships. And in the big book it talks about, you know, that we normally would not mix, you know. But I know I'm here because I am a sober member of this program. And the steps have freed me from that shame and that guilt. You know, what happened to me as a kid happened. You know, I'm responsible for my actions today. And the steps, even to this day, help me get comfortable in my own skin. And you know what? You can judge me all you want. Yeah? You can sweat up my butt. It's not. You know, the only one that can hurt me is me if I were to drink today. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous and amazing friendships, I don't have to drink today. And I want to thank all of you for being here. And I hope, my hope, which is hearing other people's experiences, that you keep coming back and you stay. Just stay and stay involved. Stay in the herd. Don't get cut from the herd. Stay active. Give back unconditionally. And the blessings will come. Thank you. Each and every one of you.